I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to Seriously after an extended Christmas break.
Yeah, it's really nice to be back in our tiny podcasting room talking to you again. But yeah, we've been off for 2 weeks.
Yeah, although you have still had our voices each week that we've been away. So, you know, thank us later. It's fine.
Yeah, so we had the Love Actually special that lots of you seem to have really liked, which is good because we really love doing it. And if you're amenable, I think some of our supporting cast from that have got ideas of other specials they would like to be on.
Yeah, indeed. Constantly.
Stephen and Barbara in particular are currently working on what they call the Rossier, which is their dossier about Ross from Friends.
It's really good, actually. If you haven't read Stephen's tweets on like what would happen after Friends finished between Ross and Rachel, i.e. he murders her, you should be.
Yeah, so that perhaps coming soon, maybe, if we can, you know, bear to.
We had a tweet from Alistair Ball. Cheers, Alistair, who said, "Finished listening to my last Christmas podcast. Good work, everyone." Just like, thanks for the encouragement. My favourite was the Seriously Pod detailed excavation of Love Actually. So I'm pleased that it made it into some people's fave Christmas scheduled podcasts. Some people seem to like our Christmassy TV and film episode. We had a tweet from Fee Kennedy who said that she belly laughed on her own in the checkout queue in the supermarket listening to the Gavin and Stacey ones.
Oh, that's so good. I watched quite a lot of Gavin and Stacey again this period. Yeah. And I feel completely vindicated in our opinions about it.
I also excellent. Watched it with my mum and my sister, the Christmas one, so that was excellent. So do you feel well rested, Caroline?
Maybe. I don't know. It's quite early in the morning. It's too early to know how
it's
I feel.
It's quite disorienting, isn't it? I was like getting on the tube. Actually, I got off the tube this morning, and although I was feeling quite like, oh God, here we go, I like looked out onto the river from Blackfriars Station, and it looked so pretty, and I was like, oh, do you know what? It's quite nice living and working in London. I'm actually not like depressed to be back. I'm quite excited.
I saw the best thing I've seen yet since returning to London on the train this morning, when I saw a sort of businessy man who'd kind of nodded off over his iPad.
Oh,
then his iPad was still like on, and on the screen he just started writing an email, and the only word he typed was productivity.
And oh babe, you can.
If it wasn't so invasive and awful, I would have taken a picture of that, because I felt like that's how London feels this morning.
Yeah, that's so sums up.
Speaking of emails.
Yeah, we had a really nice email from Kanika Singh saying that she grew up in the Indian subcontinent, Colombo, Delhi, Mumbai, moved to Texas, spent a year at LSE, and now she's back in San Antonio. And she said that she grew up primarily with British media, so although she loves listening to US pop culture stuff, there's a special place in her heart for British stuff. And she's put in brackets, yay, colonial holdovers, which made me laugh. And she's also recommended that we have a go at Jane the Virgin. She says, it's very silly, but fantastic, which is something that I've really wanted to watch for ages, actually.
Yeah, I've been recommended that a few times from various people. We should definitely give that a go.
Definitely.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Kanika.
Lots of you have already been getting in touch via Twitter and email, but if you want to do so, all the details on how you can do that are on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
The first thing we were going to talk about this week is joy. The David O. Russell film, right?
Yes, starring Jennifer Lawrence, and about, her name's Joy Mangana, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so about, it's a, you know, it's a real life story of a woman called Joy who invented, well, the first thing she invented was a mop. She went on to invent lots and lots of other things, but the story that this film tells is about how she invents this mop, against the odds, manages to sell it, and makes loads of money.
Yeah, but it's not like a straightforward biopic, is it?
No.
It's quite David O. Russell-y, but it's quite surreal and jumps about in time and stuff. But it, yeah, it's basically about the process of trying to get this mop made and how it became so popular, sort of against the odds.
Listen to me. I'll tell you what's going to come of you. You are going to grow up and be a strong, smart young woman. Go to school. Meet a fine young man. Have beautiful children of your own. And you're gonna build wonderful things. And that is what is going to happen to you.
So when you talk about it, it sounds very standardy, like a woman from ordinary background goes on to become famous person we have heard of, against all odds, big struggle, blah, blah, blah. Sounds very like standard inspiring biopic, doesn't it? But I didn't find the viewing experience similar to that.
No, and actually I felt that part of the reason it worked was because it took that kind of standard American dream narrative and kind of poked at it in places, you know. So like the fact that it's mostly narrated by her grandmother, who then dies partway through, but sort of carries on talking.
Yeah.
And at one point actually like appears to her as if she's still there.
Yeah.
Which I don't think happens in your average sort of rags to riches.
No, and story. There's scenes where she's talking to herself as a child and lots of dreamlike sequences.
Yeah, stuff I really, really liked about. So her, Joy's mother is a kind of, I don't know if you go as far to say that she's agoraphobic, but she doesn't like to leave the house.
It's a bit or indeed, of a recluse, isn't she?
Yeah, or indeed her room. And she just sits on her bed the whole time watching soap operas. And one of the brilliant things is that the passage of time is shown in this soap opera by what the women in it are wearing, what their hair looks like. So when she's watching it when Joy's a child, they look different to how they do when she's watching it when she's a grown up, obviously. And obviously Joy's, this soap opera has just been on in her head her entire life.
Yeah.
And quite often she has, her dreams are framed through it. So she will appear in the soap opera and will work out some kind of subconscious issues.
Yeah.
Using the characters, you know, which is just a bit more interesting than a kind of, yeah, great man slash woman story.
Yeah. And lots of people I've noticed didn't love this film, it seems to be. See, I mean, I don't know if I'm bubbly. I think I'm being very bubbly here.
I've not really read any reviews or anything of it, because I only saw it last night.
Basically, just some people I've seen kind of tweeting about it anecdotally haven't loved it. But the playfulness of it was what I really liked. I really liked that I didn't feel like it was taking itself too seriously. There were points where I did find it overly sentimental.
Wasn't a bit cheesy.
I wasn't that into kind of the opening. Because it is so, you know, American dream fairy story, it is playing around with those tropes. There's a bit at the beginning where she's a kid and she's talking about, you know, her dream and her life. And then her friend says, you know, you need a prince in there. And she's like, oh, I don't need a prince because I make things. I'm, you know, and I found that a bit heavy-handed and a bit like, this is a feminist story. And there's also a title card at the beginning that says, like, based on the real stories of daring women who, like, built America or something. And it's a bit over the top and it's a bit like, okay, we get it. Starring Jennifer Lawrence, she's going to be a real, like, badass woman, we get it. But I did like all the kind of moments where it wasn't very linear, wasn't like a fixed narrative, I thought were really fun. And I also thought David O. Russell plays really well with the idea that because this is a film about TV and how, you know, TV really entering the consciousness of people changed how they made decisions and how they viewed the world and what they bought, etc. He plays around a lot with kind of like TV style shots. So it opens in that soap opera stuff you were talking about. And I feel like lots of the shots and stuff are quite influenced by the way that the QVC stuff might have been shot. Like there's lots of rotating shots where you feel like the camera's moving around slowly. And we know that at the QVC studio, they've got this big rotating stage that has all these different kinds of sections of a home in. There's also a really great line with Bradley Cooper, who's obviously in this film but only appears maybe halfway through.
He's not in it very much. I think if it wasn't Bradley Cooper, you'd say it was a cameo.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he plays the sort of head of QVC who kind of gives her a chance to sell her mop on screen.
Right, but people are excited to see Bradley Cooper because they like the whole Bradley Cooper, Jennifer Lawrence thing.
Yeah.
And he has a line when he does finally appear saying, oh, people think stardom is about the face. but actually it's about the voice and the hands.
Mm.
And the first shots where you see Bradley Cooper, you don't see his face, you only see his hands and you hear his voice. And I felt there was a moment in the cinema where the people who were really expecting Bradley Cooper got it at that point. And then there's the next shot is him at a conference table, because he's like basically someone who's running QVC essentially in a boardroom, and you see his face, and then the rest of the cinema was like, oh no, it's Bradley Cooper, it's Bradley Cooper. And I thought that was really funny how they had Bradley Cooper talking about the way they were shooting QVC, and they were using those same
on
techniques
him,
on him before he'd even said those lines.
And actually that same bit reminded me of, did you see What Maisie Knew?
No.
That film, so that was a really nice
Henry James novel.
Yeah, really nicely shot, all from the point of view of the girl. So there was an awful lot of like her being half the height of adults, so you only saw half the adults.
Oh, that's fun.
That same bit where you first see Bradley Cooper, Jennifer Lawrence and her ex-husband have come to QVC's headquarters to try and get 5 minutes in front of an executive to pitch her mop. And her ex-husband is like trying to talk their way in, and he's standing up talking to the other men, and she's just like sat on a bench. And the camera focuses on her, so you see like two-thirds of the men and all of her. And there's just very much this feeling of like, she's the one with all the ideas, she's the one with the business plan, and yet she's just sat there letting them, and the men are just talking over her head.
It's a real boys club moment, isn't it? You're not part of the gang. I loved those kinds of things. I also came away from it, apparently this is completely wrong, but I was like, I thought the aspect ratio was really weird at that, wasn't it? And apparently it was completely normal.
Something about it
felt like watching TV to me. So obviously my brain's gone like, oh yeah, it must have been the aspect ratio, and it must have been something else. I'm not making any sense, but you know, it felt very like he'd consciously played around with that idea.
Also, we have to talk about the bit where Joy becomes a cowboy at the end, because that I absolutely, my heart was full of love during that.
Same, it was, me too.
It was brilliant.
And I know that some people are going to be like, that was ridiculous, because there's basically this whole shot where she's like putting on sunglasses because she's just basically done this amazing business.
Well, she goes down to Texas to kind of sort out some guy that's been screwing her over business-wise, and because it's Texas, like he's all wearing a Stetson and stuff, and she's just wearing like normal clothes, isn't she?
Didn't she have a leather jacket?
She's wearing like a black leather jacket, otherwise she's just wearing like trousers. But she kind of like marches down the street, all sort of like someone like marching into a saloon, and the whole way it's shot and like the sort of Texas scenery and everything, you just immediately go like, ah, cowboys.
But that's the thing, because it's, again, it's like the beginning, we open with soap opera, and then we go into children's fairy tale, and then you have, you know, American Dream style stuff, and then you've got like cowboy shootout at the end. He's really playing around with all these great classic American ideas of storytelling, and they're all kind of merging together, and it's all a bit weird. And so I can see why some people would watch it and walk away and be like, what? But I loved it.
Well, it stood out all the more for me because the trailers they played at the screening I went to, all the film, I guess because we're in Oscar season, right? And what do the Oscars love more than like films about real famous men played by famous men? Just film after film seemed to be like, there's like the Wall Street one, and there's the boxing one, just all of these, like,
and the newsroom,
the newsroom one.
No, it's not called the newsroom, that's the TV show, but you know what I mean, the Boston Globe,
the Boston thing. Globe, yeah. Catholic Church investigation one. Just trailer after trailer was for biopics of famous men.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe I'm doing them a disservice, maybe they are more interesting than that, but we'll have to find out. But the trailers made them look like very straightforward.
But even women, like the Danish girl, I don't want to go see the Danish girl.
No, I don't either.
It looks, I'm sorry, it just looks a bit twee and a bit boring. What I liked about this was it was a bit more fun.
Yeah, so it set me up to appreciate this film as more interesting and sort of weird than that, and I really like that.
Yeah, because I haven't seen a whole load of David O. Russell films. I've obviously seen Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle.
Yeah, those are the only two I've seen as well.
Which I thought were good and fine. But I wouldn't be like, I would watch them again, particularly.
I would watch American Hustle again.
I don't know, because I found American Hustle, like, very indulgent. And maybe,
it is.
Yeah, very indulgent and very kind of, like, circle jerky and, like, look at the men, like, doing crazy shit. And I'm like, I preferred Joy endlessly. Like, and I thought it was funny how, I mean, obviously making these films does not happen overnight, but I thought it was interesting how we had American Hustle, and then obviously American Hustle became a talking point way after its release, after the Sony leak, and the fact that Bradley Cooper was getting paid so much more than Jennifer Lawrence, etc. The men got way more money than the women in that film. And then we have this film, also by David O. Russell, which is kind of American Hustle-y in that it's about, like, it's an American dreamy, how can we make lots of money style thing. But we've got the woman centred, and it's all about the woman, and presumably Jennifer Lawrence got paid the most for that film.
You'd really hope so. Really, she's hope. In every single shot.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I mean, so I thought it was interesting that we've had that kind of narrative in our culture happening at the same time as these films have developed from him. But I mean, I'm presumably there. It's completely coincidental, nothing to do with each other. I don't know.
I think it's perhaps that there is something to do with it, but it's maybe more the kind of marketing films as including strong women.
Is now a thing. Yeah.
And I think the reaction to the Sony leak was part of that culture shift.
Yeah. It's like, did you see... Sorry, this is just a pet peeve of mine that's just constantly going around in my head, how they're marketing Pride and Prejudice and Zombies as like a feminist take on Jane Austen novels.
Are they really? I haven't seen that.
Makes me want to die.
Oh, but I really want to see that film.
I know, so
for zombie
I,
reasons,
obviously.
Not for...
obviously, I'm going to go, but like, please don't think I'm that stupid. Please. Yeah, but I really liked it. Would see again.
Would see again, and would recommend listeners, if you've also been put off by any of the reaction to it, don't be, and give it a go.
Yeah.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Sherlock was a thing.
The Sherlock special, which was on New Year's Day, and Sherlock, I feel like, is always divisive, but it felt to me like it was particularly divisive this time.
Yeah.
That the instant reaction to it was some people really, really loved it and immediately wanted to spend all their time delving into the minutiae of it, and a lot of others, to be fair, I think a lot of more casual watchers who maybe haven't seen all of Sherlock ever, we're a bit like, what even was that? I don't like it. I didn't understand it. Ugh.
So do you think we should put our Sherlock watching cards on the table?
I think we probably should, yeah. So I have seen all of Sherlock. I think around the second series of it, sort of briefly flirted with becoming an actual fan of it. Mm-hmm. And then I think the third series was just a bit too self-referential and that kind of waned again for me. So it was a very brief flirtation with it.
Each series is 3 episodes, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so in that case, I watched the whole of the first series, and I'm sure I've watched some other episodes in between, but I didn't love the first. I mean, I know a lot of people really enjoyed the first series and think it's gone downhill from there, but I watched the first series and was quite like, I found it pretentious, basically. I found it annoying and a bit up itself.
Yeah, so we come at it from slightly different places, but I think both from a a place of disillusion, if not more.
Yeah, and I also like love Martin Freeman, and I like watching that kind of program. So I don't think I'm like completely anti it. I just was a bit like, there's my overriding feeling is one of vague irritation.
Also, you don't like Benedict Cumberbatch.
I really don't like Benedict Cumberbatch, so that is an issue for me.
Yeah, I used to like Benedict Cumberbatch, and now find him irritating. So yeah. I feel like I've travelled the journey as far as he's concerned.
Yeah.
So the Sherlock special has been coming forever. It feels like I think they filmed it quite a while ago, and it's just
so
been,
long ago because I was an intern at the Telegraph in autumn 2014, and during that time wrote an article like, look at the pictures of them in Victorian gear.
Yeah,
so that was literally well over a year ago.
It's possibly a bit harsh to say this, but I almost feel like the marketing and promotional arm of Sherlock is now better than the program.
Yeah,
in that they did such a good job of releasing the Victorian images but none of the modern day ones from it, and having people either believing or completely baffled as to why a show that was set in the 21st century was suddenly being set in the 19th century. The device with that was irritating. It was this whole, the most irritating thing from the last full series of Sherlock was this idea of his memory palace, his mind palace, being this kind of vast alternate universe in his head.
All right, Derren Brown.
Where he he can remember things and work out ideas and do his cite his improbable deductions.
I'm already also, like dying.
I know you are. I'm trying to take it seriously, okay?
I know.
And where he like keeps his emotions and stuff, basically. And the idea of this was that, but you don't, the twist comes halfway through the program.
Yeah, right, so
really.
You're watching it and you're like, okay, this is a special, and it's just an isolated one-off special, and they're doing it, period.
Yeah, they're investigating a kind of 19th century gothic horror-y mystery called The Abominable Bride, about a bride who apparently kills herself and then reappears and kills her husband. And it's all quite, I was quite enjoying that.
And full spoiler warning, we're going to ruin
sorry.
It if you haven't seen it. So just, so stop, go watch it,
come
rejoin
back.
Us. You've been watching it for what, an hour? Nearly an hour? 45
yeah,
minutes?
Yeah, something like that. It's about halfway.
And you're like, Moriarty appears, basically, right?
Yes.
And then you're like, okay, something kind of weird is going on. And then there's this whole scene where they're talking about, like, how he could be back from the dead and blah, blah, blah. And then he's like, it's not the falling, it's the landing, which is a reference, I think, to the fact that Sherlock jumped off a building in a previous episode.
Yeah.
And he said that when he came back or something.
It's not, the line is, I think, it's not the fall that kills you.
Yeah, it's the landing. And then as he says that line, it all goes into modern day and you're like, oh my God, what is happening? This is so annoying.
Our friend Elizabeth Minkle, who was on the podcast before Christmas, she is far more interested in Sherlock than we are, I think. And she said that for her, the line that actually gave her sort of chills was when there's a bit where Mycroft is kind of pompously lecturing Sherlock and John about something.
Yeah,
and
who is fat in the old
days? Well, because he is in the books, you see.
Oh, right, okay. I thought that was just like a weird, like, laughs thing.
No, so we'll come on to that in a second. But so he suddenly, he's talking kind of in period vernacular, and then suddenly he says, it's the virus in the data. Like, he has this kind of incongruous line of contemporary language. And Elizabeth said that was the moment for her where she was like, ah. Okay,
this is not
what I think it is.
Yeah.
And so we should say as well that this is, it's incredibly both self and canon referential.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where, so I watched it with my parents, who I think, like you, have seen a couple of other episodes, but not necessarily in order, like perhaps as they've been repeated after broadcast, they've caught them. But they've both read the, Conan Doyle stories, I think nearly all of them, if not all of them. And they were sat there going, what's this? Who's that guy? Why there? It was not remotely approachable to the casual viewer. I can't even imagine if this was the first Sherlock thing you'd seen, it would have made no sense at all.
Yeah.
Because it was so internally referential to other elements of its own programme, but then also, stuff like quite a lot of the dialogue in the first 5 minutes is exactly the same as from the first episode. It's verbatim.
Oh.
Mr. Holmes! I do wish you'd let me know when you're planning to come home.
I hardly knew myself, Mrs. Hudson. Had some trouble with dismembered country squires. They're notoriously difficult to schedule.
What's in there?
Never mind.
Thank you.
Did you catch a murderer, Mr. Holmes?
Caught the murderer, still looking for the legs. I think we'll call it a draw.
But they just...
I didn't even notice.
Yeah. It's verbatim, but they...
And it's all really
meta,
just wearing
different
talking
clothes.
About his story.
Yeah, so it's very, very meta. It's very sort of intertextual, but it's also, and this is where I take this on other people's authority because I haven't seen all of them, but there are, you know, there have been a lot of TV and film adaptations of Sherlock Holmes throughout the 20th century. Apparently, it's incredibly referential, both in dialogue and visually, to those.
Right.
So the whole thing, it just comes, I said this on Twitter after watching it, that the whole thing just smacked of grown-up boys being allowed to play in the dressing-up box and getting to spin out all of their kind of fanboy fantasies.
Exactly, because that's fun, and I love that kind of thing. I love thinking like, oh, that's a very subtle, nice reference to that. I love that kind of thing in culture. But there's a point where it's like, okay, you're alienating people by only allowing people who are part of that world to enjoy this because it's completely incomprehensible. Yeah. And it's like, who's the guy who did The Wire? I can't remember his name. There's a famous interview with him where someone, I think it's Mark Kermode, is like, what about the casual viewer? They're lost. And he's like, fuck the casual viewer, fuck the casual viewer. Which I get, but like, not with Sherlock. Come on.
I was kind of ashamed of this because it was a slightly right-wing opinion, but I was like, the BBC spent money on this. Like, this was our money that you spent on this. But those people who paid for this can't enjoy it.
Right, maybe.
And I don't know, that annoyed me.
And I'm someone who's very pro, like, making things for the fans.
Mm.
But it didn't quite feel like that either, did it?
No, it felt like torturing the fans.
Mm.
Maybe that's wrong. Maybe people will write and correct me on that. But it did feel a bit like, because you know, then I dived briefly into Tumblr to see how that fandom was enjoying it, and I saw a lot of things that people, like theories that people were positing and stuff, about how actually Mary is Moriarty, and you can see, and I was quite persuaded by the post I read about that lots of the visual references and lots of.
I thought she was already evil.
Well, I think she... I can't remember if she is or not. This is the thing. I think...
I thought that he was like, wait, I was going to marry you, and actually you're not...
Oh, no, they sort that out again.
She's from MI5, that's what that was.
But he kind of basically... It's very sweet. He kind of says, like, your past is your business, your future is my privilege kind of thing. And he, like, makes his peace with the fact that she has this whole other life. The point is that I think we're not done with this. I think if they ever make any more Sherlock, they're gonna deconstruct their own deconstruction, and there's going to be more inside it.
Yeah.
And, I mean... Inception is already a complicated film. It didn't need to be remade in this form.
Yeah, exactly. I think there are two things that we should probably touch upon. A, gayness, B, women.
Yep.
So there's loads of, like, obviously, what a significant group of Sherlock fans are interested in is whether Sherlock and Watson are actually, like, a gay couple or love each other and are frustrated by it. And
the John Sherlock ship is massive.
Yeah, it's huge. And I'm kind of into it. Yeah. I think it's cool. Though I felt very much watching this that the real, if there is a slash couple in it, it's definitely Sherlock Moriarty and not Sherlock Watson. Watson's the kind of guy you want to, like, have a nice cup of tea with on the sofa, but I really feel like Sherlock is, you know, he's going to bone Moriarty if he's going to bone anyone. I always thought that would be a really cool thing to do with a Sherlock adaptation. It's probably way overdue, considering they, like, changed Watson's gender in order for there to be some flirting in the Sky series Elementary. But if it happens like this, it's going to be a bit annoying. Like,
there's also a whole, and we haven't got time to go into it now, but there's also this whole idea of kind of queer baiting and the idea that you put enough kind of breadcrumbs of that in order to interest that.
That's exactly what this feels
that,
like.
That kind of group of people. But you don't actually bother to, you know, Elizabeth, I think, is actually going to write for us about this.
That sounds really interesting, because that's exactly what it feels like. It feels a bit like they're toying with the viewer, and they're being like, oh, you want this to happen? Like, here's some, like, weird shots of someone with a pistol in their mouth, or blah, blah, blah. But we won't actually bother to investigate those kinds of feelings properly or with respect. It's just, like, a bit of titillation and, like... That's kind of annoying because you're like, wait, if this could be a proper thing, can we do it for real rather than just, like, kind of mocking it?
Kind of fiddling with it,
It feels like it's being mocked to me in a weird way.
The idea of it, I know. So, yeah, that's definitely... I felt more like that in the special than I have in any of the previous ones.
Yeah.
Because I think it just feels more of... And this is what I mean about them torturing fans. It just... That was part of it, that it felt both more overt, like there was far more of them, like, talking about their feelings and like, sitting close together in dark greenhouses and stuff.
Yeah, you must have desires.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff, which is like, do it properly, please.
Yeah. And then, the women thing as well.
Oh my God, I made notes in my phone when I was watching it because I was so angry.
So there was one thing that I liked about the women's subplot, and this, someone said this to me in an email as well, that they at least they used period-specific language for the suffragettes.
Oh, okay.
So calling them the Monstrous Regiment.
That's a thing.
That was a thing. That was a 19th century thing.
Yeah.
That was, you know, those awful postcards saying like, oh, she's a suffragette, she won't cook your dinner.
Yeah, and with that baby screaming.
It was the anti-suffragette language of the thing. So that, like, top marks for that, well done.
Yeah.
But.
Well, there were lots of little things that annoyed me. And the first one was how, again, this is kind of similar to the queer baiting, I think. Maybe this is like lady baiting, I don't know what to call it. But there's a line right at the beginning with, I can't remember the landlady's name.
Mrs. Hudson,
where she is annoyed because she doesn't get lines in.
Yeah, she's just a plot device.
Yeah, she gets annoyed because in Watson's magazine stories, she doesn't get lines. And she says, I'm not just a plot device. Which really wound me up because those were all her lines. Her lines throughout the whole thing were just about that.
Mm.
So it's a way of like getting her to like say something as though the issue's being dealt with when it's not being dealt with
without
at all.
She still is
just
any lines.
Do you know what I mean? She still is just like a background figure. She's still nobody. And that was the same with all the women in this. And I'm like, you can't just shoehorn like vaguely feminist lines into your thing as a cheat to get out of having to deal with your female characters properly. Wound me up so much. And then that happens like the whole way through with like all the you know, the Abominable Bride stuff. Like, ostensibly, this is a story about women, basically, right? Because...
Or a woman, at least.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and then it turns out that there isn't just one bride. There's loads of brides. And he's like, this whole room is full of brides. And they're brides. Therefore, they're defined by their relationship to men. They're not even taken seriously as women who want the vote. They're just scorned women, brides. You know, like, women who were treated badly by men. And there's this line where Sherlock is, like, stood amongst all the suffragettes at the end, who were all wearing KKK hoods.
I don't know why they're wearing pointy hats.
Yeah, like, the language may have been expertly, you know, period, but the costume, not so much. Yeah, and Sherlock is walking around explaining to them, you know, why they wanted, you know, what their whole mission was and blah, blah, blah. One of my friends from school tweeted, like, oh, you could not define Moffat's story writing more than a man walking around a room full of women explaining to them what their feminist mission actually was.
Yep.
But there's a line where he says, ignored, patronised, dismissed. And I was like, are you talking about the women in this or your female audience? Because you literally could be talking about either.
Yeah, and also I tweeted about this and someone said, well, you know, fair enough, it was patronising, but he is the title character of the show and he is the central detective. So it's not that unusual that he should therefore do the big reveal. But that's not right at all, because in every Poirot, every like Golden Age detective thing,
the murderer
gets to do the monologuing. They get to do their big reveal. They get to like explain, well, I always hated her.
They say like, it was because you hated her, wasn't it? And they're like, but you would too if you had been there. And then they like go on
actually
their run.
Excellently parodied in a Mitchell and Webb sketch I'm going to try and find on
great.
YouTube for the show notes. Yeah, exactly, where a kind of, I think he's called Monsieur Voirot, played by David Mitchell, basically condemns someone in a drawing room based on the fact that they're doing an evil voice, and then they do the whole monologue in the evil voice.
That's
but that's exactly it. So no, it should have been the ringleader of the Abominable Brides should have explained what's happening. But of course not, because she's a woman.
Yeah, and then in fact, when they did get a woman to come up and like do the big reveal, she takes her veil off, and it's Moriarty, another man. Like, it's just, you know, it's annoying. It annoyed me as soon as we got to the 45-minute mark and they were like, actually, this is all in Sherlock's head. I was like, no, I'm sorry. I know that it's not quite the same as, like, it was all a dream, but after you've invested in something for an hour, you don't want to be told it was all fake. Yeah. Like, you just don't.
Yeah, and one of the best comments I saw about this was someone saying that, actually, if you were to kind of do an honest subtitles of this, it would just be, I'm clever. Clever, clever, clever. Look at me. Clever, clever, clever.
Absolutely. So,
and that's not... I don't know. I don't find that enjoyable to watch.
And the story didn't progress at all. So it was a real filler.
It all happened in about... If you take the 21st century storyline to be the actual timeline of the show, it all happened in about 4 to 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Someone tweeted like... Sorry, I know we keep saying that, which is annoying. But someone did tweet, oh, so just a plot summary of what happened in Sherlock. A man got out of a plane and into a car. And you're like, yep. That's all that happened. It wasn't enough of a like, here, this is what you want, fans, for it to be justifiable. It was they were being kind of, I felt, toyed with and mocked, as you did, I think. So it's not... Rah! basically. In summary.
So as you could tell, it made us quite cross. If you have strong feelings about it, though, do tell us, because I am interested to hear the kind of the positive. If you did love it, I want to hear why.
Thank you.
So, Caroline, you've been watching First Dates.
I have, and it's been such an enjoyable experience.
Has it? I really want to know which ones you watched, because I stopped watching it towards the end.
I don't know. I've just been watching random ones on 4OD.
Yeah.
And then I also went and watched this brilliant YouTube playlist called Best of First Dates.
Excellent.
That has lots of clips from previous, like ones that aren't on 4OD anymore, but like sort of clip montages. You know, everyone loves like a show with a format, a set format.
Yeah.
I'm no exception. When it's a format I get on with, I find it so relaxing just to have different people slotted into the same style so that I know when there's going to be feelings, I know when there's going to be laughs. Yeah. It's just, you know.
I love the music of First Dates as well, though.
Yeah.
Dun, 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 dun. You're like, oh yes, I'm ready.
And like, I love the whole thing. What's the maitre d's name?
Fred.
Yeah, I love him. He's great. Yeah, I love the kind of supporting cast that are there every time.
Yeah, the waitresses and everything. The thing is with Fred though is that I'm like, I'm 80% sure I like him, and then like 20% of me is like, could be a serial killer.
Yes, actually, I know what you mean. Yeah, sometimes the little comments he makes when people are like, he sees them coming through the glass door, you're like, oh, okay.
It's a bit weird, Fred.
It's a bit weird, Fred.
Yeah, he's maybe. Like, okay, Fred. And at the end of every episode, he's like, everybody is looking for love. And you're like, sure, all right, Fred, have your moment.
But yeah, I just really, really liked it. I found it really relaxing. It's already become kind of a core TV show for me.
Excellent.
I'm now really looking forward to actually, I mean, is there still a series on? Is it still going?
I'm not sure, because I was watching it quite religiously and then my record fell off somehow. So I haven't seen it since just before Christmas, but I don't know if it was on. There was a special because apparently some people got engaged.
Ah.
In fact, I know exactly which couple this was. So just for anyone who hasn't seen First Dates, it's a show set in a restaurant. The restaurant is actually around the corner from where we work, which is quite fun.
It's very exciting.
Yes, there's loads of shots of like the wasabi we go to for lunch sometimes. So they shut down the restaurant to the public in order to film this program where they invite lots of people to come on and have a blind date. So they match them broadly, seems to be like based on age and like if they've got like a strong mutual interest or if, you know, those kinds of things. And then you just watch maybe five couples on their first dates over the course of the episode. And then occasionally if someone's a real character and their first date went badly, they can come back and have another first date with somebody different. And then there was this couple in this series where there was this guy and he kept saying, so they do all these interviews to camera with each of them beforehand. And he kept being like, yeah, I was in a relationship for like 9 years and then we got engaged, but then the engagement got broken off. And he was like, and now I've just got this like really nice house and I really need someone to come and live in my house. But he kept using the word property to describe it. And I was like, is there a less romantic thing to say than like, I want someone to come and share my property? Like, it's so weird and like Austin without the like romance. And anyway, so he was like, obviously someone who was desperate to settle down,
be married. Yeah,
he really wanted it. And he went on this date with this girl and like they got on well, and then it seems like the next thing that's happening is they're getting engaged on a special called The Proposal.
Oh.
I mean, it's kind of cute, yeah. But I was kind of like, babe, okay, I mean, good for you, you've got what you wanted. But what I like about it is that there are some like sometimes you watch it and you're like, oh my god, they get on so well.
Yes,
so
I love well that.
I don't know, did you see the two girls? There was this one episode where these two girls were like so into each other, and it was so obvious from the moment they sat down, and they were like giggling constantly.
Was it the one where one of them was a weightlifter?
Yeah, I think
yes,
so.
Yes, I
maybe
know what you mean.
And they like, there's a bit where they're outside smoking, and she goes in for a kiss, and they like bump heads, and then they just like burst into hysterical laughter, and they like use that clip on all the like intros each time. But it was just so brilliant to watch because they were so, and it just like makes me like, oh, I'm so happy for you.
Yeah, because that's I think one of the reasons why I like it. Whereas I'm not massively into most of those kind of scripted reality shows like Made in Chelsea or whatever.
Yeah,
is because there's very little cringe in First Dates.
Well, when there is cringe, though, I feel like you cringe big.
Yeah, yeah, okay. But generally, it's quite sort of charming and, as I say, relaxing. I don't have that kind of constant sense of uneasiness that some things like this give me.
Yeah, I think that there are some where you're like, when you know straight away that they're not going to fancy each other, there's a lot of ones where it's a guy who's kind of nerdy and smart, and maybe he's been to Oxford or Cambridge, and he's talking a lot to camera about how difficult he finds it going on dates and how he can't do it, and then the girl is invariably very, very nice but doesn't actually fancy him.
Yeah.
And he's always, and she's really sweet.
Yeah, that is a bit
and
awkward.
I hate watching those where he's like can't get the words out, like when they're sat at the table and you're like, oh, I feel for you so much, but I also just like can't, I need to look away, like it's too much.
Yeah, that's true actually. You're the ones where, but I suppose because it seems like the mission of the show is not to humiliate people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is quite nice, and I would like more reality TV like this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they do edit it to like look more awkward in certain situations, and I'm sure they edit it to make it look like they're like just eye fucking the entire time. Like, you know, those ones where they're like literally looking each other up and down the entire time. Yeah. You're like, can you really be doing this like for an hour?
But I suppose it actually has something in common with the Great British Bake Off in the sense that they seem to pick contestants in the hope that they will succeed, not in
to
the
watch
hope
them fail,
not the hope that they'll have a meltdown. So.
Yeah, yeah, and I think. It does tend to be like just nice, normal people. It always seems very like, okay, these are just like people you would meet on the street. And that's kind of what's so nice about it. Yeah. It's such a basic setup, but it works.
Yeah. So yeah, massively pro first dates. Can't recommend it enough. Actually, someone on Twitter did already say that thanks to your recommendation in the, whenever it was, the last episode, they'd already watched it and they were very grateful as well. So, you know.
It's so funny because it's something I feel like my specific group of friends, everybody watches. So it's the kind of thing where I feel like you can't be like, oh, you should watch First Dates, because I'll be like, duh. But, you know, especially, I don't know if our American listeners are going to be able to watch it. I don't know.
Well, I recommend this YouTube playlist, even if you can't get on 4OD. And I think there's quite a lot of clips, because it's quite a kind of clippable show. There's
definitely
a lot of kind of supercuts on YouTube.
Each plot line, if we're going to call it that, probably takes about 5 minutes overall, doesn't it? So
excellent show. So we are now back into the rhythm of weekly podcasts, you'll be pleased to hear. So for next week, I'm going to recommend Anna a film that is very close to my heart, Quartet.
Instantly I'm like, Caroline, isn't this an old person's film?
Of course it is. I love old people's films. If they are in fact old people's films, they are not.
I'm obviously teasing.
Yeah, so it's a film, it's based on a play actually, which was on quite a number of years ago and I didn't get to see, although I wish I had. And it's about a sort of retirement home for musicians, for professional musicians. So everyone who lives in this home was like a famous opera singer or part of a internationally famous string quartet or something. It stars Maggie Smith and Tom Courtenay. Billy Connolly is also in it.
Oh, great.
And the quartet of the title is, the opera Rigoletto has a really famous, just before the end, a really famous quartet. One of the like most famous examples in opera of all time of like four principals all singing at the same time really loudly, and somehow it sounds beautiful rather than terrible. And so four of the people in the home recorded a really famous version of this opera and this particular bit, and they haven't seen each other for X number of years, and now they all meet again in this retirement home.
Aww, that's cute. Okay, I'm excited. And instantly I'm thinking of Maggie Smith's music career in Lady in the Van.
Actually, it definitely has some parallels with that, because she has her character has a lot of regrets and a lot of kind of sort of shame about, you know, she, unlike a lot, some of the people in the home still just find an enormous amount of joy in their music, and they give music lessons and they give talks to young people, and they're still, even though they don't perform anymore, they're still like part of music. Whereas she's gone completely the other way, where she's like, if I can't be at the top of my game anymore, I don't want anything to do with
it. Oh, bless her. Okay, so I'm excited.
Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes and Tumblr. All the links are at newstatesman.com/srsly.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.